In this episode of Balancing the Christian Life, we talk about a Christian's relationship with money with Adam Shanks. Welcome to Balancing the Christian Life. I'm Dr. Kenny Embry. We'll talk about how to be better Christians and people in the digital age. Let's go. So when I say the word money, what do you think about? I think a Christian's relationship with these green pieces of paper is probably one of the most complex relationships we have with an inanimate object. I don't mind admitting I have been in debt for a long time, and I am just beginning to see a little light at the end of the tunnel. But as my older two kids got into college and became acquainted with the wonderful world of student loans, it made me re-examine how a Christian needs to see finances. The money talk is probably one of those subjects you don't have with a lot of people. It has the potential to be embarrassing and often tells the story of some chapters of our lives we'd rather forget. However, God is not embarrassed in the least to talk about our relationship with money. He has specific advice on how to make it, how to spend it, and how to have a relationship with it. We are all familiar with the verse in 1 Timothy 6, where we are told that the love of money is the root of all evil. However, we simply don't have an option of not living with, without, or around money. Howard Dayton, a businessman and Bible scholar, counted 2,350 verses in the Bible which dealt specifically with money. In other words, while we may try to avoid the topic, God is just as happy to take it head on. Adam Shanks is a fellow podcaster who hosts the program Preach Impediments, where he discusses difficult theological words to help us understand them better. He also recently published a book on Christian money management entitled In God We Trust. I haven't finished his book yet, but I knew I wanted to get his take on how Christians use money. I want you to see why he views money as a tool. Also, he has an interesting take on the parable of the shrewd money manager in Luke 16. Finally, see why he says planning too much for the future may be just as dangerous as not planning for it at all. How you doing, Adam?
I'm doing great.
You recently wrote a book about money. As Christians, we simply can't avoid money. What should a Christian's attitude toward money be?
Honestly, one of the things I dig into a lot in the book is about the attitude we have about money. The truth is, like you said, money is unavoidable. It is something that we spend a lot of time with. We spend a lot of time trying to make money. We spend a lot of time spending that money. We spend probably too little time saving that money.
Yeah.
Or using it in ways that are probably more intentional and life-changing. But it's the attitude that really defines how we handle money. It's not necessarily the step-by-step approach, although that's important. Mm-hmm. It's the attitude itself. It's, are we coming at it as a tool that God gives us to use for His glory? Mm-hmm. Are we using it for selfish gain, selfish purposes, selfish motivation? Or do we approach it as a good thing and a neutral thing, a bad thing? We tend to all come to money with different attitudes. And honestly, a lot of that comes probably from our experiences, our upbringing. Those types of experiences tend to shape the way that we handle money.
I could not disagree with you, that's for sure. When I was raised, and the way that I was raised, there were some things we spent a lot of money on and some things that we did not spend any money on at all. And I guess as a kid, one of the things that I figured out was some of these things are important, some of these things are not important, based on were we willing to shell out something for it or not. But let me go back to, what should a Christian's attitude toward money be? The fact of the matter is, Jesus told us the love of money is the root of all evil.
Let me take this in two different directions.
Okay.
One is perspective, and the other is attitude. And I think they go hand in hand whenever we're talking about handling money God's way. the perspective side of things, we need to handle money as a tool.
Yeah. You know,
tools are useful, and tools can be damaging when they're not used the right way.
Yeah.
I often use the illustration of a hammer. Several years ago, my children were in the backyard playing. Our older son was using a stormtrooper gun and kept shooting his younger brother. Mm-hmm. And his younger brother had a mallet in his hand and decided to whack his brother across the face with it. Nothing like eye for an eye, right? Like that's the way this works. A mallet can be very useful when used to hammer something into the ground, a tent peg or something like that. Right. But it's a horrible tool for getting your brother back. And we're that way with money sometimes. Money is a tool. It can be used for good things that it's intended for, and it can be used for bad things. If our perspective retains the idea that money is a tool, then we'll probably handle it correctly, and we'll probably have the right sort of attitude about the money itself. Several of the things that I get into when it comes to money, and there in the book itself, there are a ton of verses. It can be used individually. It can also be used as a Bible study. But we tend to deal with probably the ones that we're most familiar with: greed, envy, covetousness. Those are things that are obviously sinful. But there are other things in Scripture like discontentment that we don't talk about as much. Or even embarrassment. We can use money as a tool for feeling embarrassed about our own situation with money. That shows a misplaced priority or perspective. The idea of deception, discontentment tends to lead to deception. You want to deceive others into making yourself look a lot richer than you really are. That whole keep up with the Joneses concept. Money leads to indulgence. It can lead to fear. People who have a lot of money, they fear losing it. And so that becomes a great motivator in their life and in their decision-making. Ego, pride, there's all sorts of attitude issues we have when it comes to money. And all of them stem from a lack of understanding that it is merely a tool. Some of us have more tools than others. That's okay.
That's true. I think one of the things that I think about with money, in the Old Testament, you can read about Job, you can read about Abraham, you can read about Isaac. And it seems to me that these guys were pretty well off. Or you could talk about Joseph, who basically had the purse strings to the Pharaoh of Egypt. And then you get to the New Testament, and everybody's dirt poor. And it doesn't seem to me that the character of a Job and a Jesus, there's some things that are very similar, and it has nothing to do with how much money they had in their bank account. That really, when you talk about that perspective, and some of these guys knew how to use money, and some of them did not. And I think you're right when you start looking at how some of these characters, like the rich fool in the New Testament, he feared losing what he had. By the way, I think that's one of the major fears all of us have. We would often sacrifice gaining something for not losing something.
There are plenty of poor people in the Old Testament, and there are also rich people in the New Testament. You look at Joseph, who we better know as Barnabas. He went and sold his land so that he could lay that money at the apostles' feet. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, it talks about, as you go through the book of Acts, that there were prominent women or rich women who would come and become disciples. Yep. There are plenty of wealthy people mentioned in the New Testament as being disciples. And while you have the rich young ruler who is told to go sell all you have and come and follow me, you don't see the same instructions given to some of these others in the New Testament. And so the issue, like you said, is not whether you have or don't have. Paul himself said, I've learned to be content in either situation. Sometimes I have plenty, sometimes I'm in want. But in any case, the goal is, where are you putting your trust?
Right.
Is your trust in riches, or is your trust in the giver of riches?
Yeah.
That always makes the difference.
In your book, you have, like you said, 13 chapters, and it would be a nice work study book for maybe a class. Because it neatly goes right into a quarter system. The old advice is avoid debt, save money, get a budget, live beneath your means. And all of this seems like it's just excellent advice. Why don't we do it?
Love your neighbor is also excellent advice. Yeah. Why don't we do it?
Good question.
There's all sorts of things we're told to do and principles we're told to follow, and we struggle to follow them because we're broken people. We want what we want, and we want it now.
Yeah.
And we're not good at the idea of deferred pleasure or looking to the future for our blessings and our benefits instead of looking to the now. Mm-hmm. And that's not always a bad thing. I think sometimes we get so caught up in following the advice that we can actually shoot ourselves in the foot sometimes.
Yeah.
If I spend all of my time, all of my younger years, saving, I've got 5 children at home.
Yeah.
But we can't buy that because we got to save. We're saving for the future. What happens if my future is a lot shorter than I thought it was going to be? And now that money, all of that work and all of that deferred pleasure is pushed off. And my children and I didn't get the experiences that we could have had all because I'm saving. That's difficult to try to balance that and try to make sure that you are making a plan that works for now and a plan that works for later.
Yeah, I think one of the things that even the most conservative of most financial planners will give you some allowance for a mortgage. I like the perspective that you're taking. I think one of the things that extreme financial planners keep on sacrificing the present for the future, and those of us who get into credit card debt keep on sacrificing the future for the present.
Yes.
Both of those are extremes. Do you think there's a balanced way to think about this?
Absolutely. Even the Bible itself talks about the idea of planning for the future and the importance of planning for the future. Several of the Proverbs get into just that idea of go to the ant. Does the work so that it will have whenever it needs. And so you've got that concept. But then you've got Jesus who makes the statement also in the context of money of do not worry about tomorrow, for today has enough trouble of its own.
Yeah.
On one side, we should be looking at the future. On the other side, we should be looking at now. Which one is correct? The easy answer is both. Both are right. Both are good. And I think anytime you are making decisions that rob the future or rob the present, you're going to extremes. There is a way to balance your budgeting in a way that allows you to enjoy today, but also set yourself up for the future. If I spend everything I have now, or even go into debt now, then I'm robbing the future, as you said.
Yeah.
Or if I, like you said, don't spend anything now, I'm robbing today. Why not plan to spend some now and save some? Like that, this is not a hard thing to imagine, being able to do that. And one of the things I like to lead people through the process all the way through any sort of financial planning is dream. Put your dreams on paper. Right. This is what I want a year from now. This is what I want 5 years from now. But then make decisions that match the dreams instead of always just pushing everything off to the future. There's just that balance in there.
You have mentioned balance several times now. That makes a lot of sense to me. I will say this. If you want to get a couple to fight about anything, why don't you bring up the finances? Because that'll start a fight right quick there, Adam. Why do so many married couples fight about the finances?
Honestly, I think it goes back to what we mentioned earlier, is most people come to a discussion with baggage. And so if you take a man who has lived in a very wealthy home and married to a woman who has grown up in a very tight home, they're going to think about grocery shopping differently. Even the simple decisions that come with making money are going to be different. You take somebody who has grown up with save, yeah, always drilled into their head, and somebody who has never heard that, they're going to approach money differently. And I think a couple has to come together, and this is true in finances or really any issue. They have to be willing to talk through the differences and find the value in each perspective and bring those to the table.
Right.
If we're always looking for the problem in the way the other person understands it, then we, of course, all we're going to do is fight. But if we're looking for, okay, so you're good at saving, I'm not. You lead that part of the discussion. I'm good at spending and you're not. Let me lead that part of the discussion and let's contribute to the balance that we're looking for.
I think one of your main strategies, and it's a strategy that a lot of financial planners would talk about, is the importance of budgeting. Why is budgeting so important?
I like the way it said, and I don't even know who initially said this, but budgeting is telling your money where to go before it goes where you didn't want it to. And that's really all it is. Budgeting is putting on paper what you're going to do and committing to it. Mm-hmm. Now, what's funny about budgeting is, first of all, there are people who are scared of it, and it's ridiculous. You're either going to tell your money what to do on paper, or you're going to see where your money went on paper, but it's going to be on paper one way or the other. One way is more beneficial than the other. So why not choose that way, which is to create a budget? But the part that cracks me up about budgeting, though, is that there are so many people, and I've been guilty of this myself, who are good at putting budgets on paper. And that's where it ends, like that. That's as far as it goes. And then we get to the end of the month and go, well, that was a waste. Let's try it again. And we put it on paper, but then do not actually live by it. Right. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. Unrealistic budgets, or it might be just a lack of commitment from one partner or the other in a marriage. Or it might be a budget that just is too complicated to really follow. And so people don't actually live by it. It's so broken down that it's really hard to even deal with. I think one of the main reasons people don't do well on budgets is because they don't actually understand how money works. And so they think, oh, I'll put $200 in this category when your power costs $400, not $200.
Yeah.
That won't work. And so you get a lot of difficulties there. Budgeting is, honestly, it's a four-letter word to most people, but it is important because it is honestly sometimes the best way to get a marriage partner involved in the money process. Generally speaking, you got one nerd who's married to someone who's not a spreadsheet oriented. Mm-hmm. So it's a really good way of getting the person who likes to lay everything out involved in the process. Why not let that be part of the process? Now, again, the honest reason is because then the person who doesn't like think numbers on spreadsheets also doesn't want to live on a budget. So that's where you have to compromise.
You talk about the importance of two people coming together. What if you can't get the other person to the table?
When you have a scenario where something is going to be spent, whether it's budgeted or not, whether that be a school function, it could be just a miscellaneous expense. It could be, a piece of furniture that I found on the side of the road that I just had to get. who knows what it is? From a spreadsheet maker's point of view, that money gets spent either way.
Yeah.
Because the non-participating party in the budget-making duties, they went and spent the money.
Right.
So sometimes the easiest way to bring peace is for the spreadsheet maker to just budget in the unexpected frivolous spending of the party who is going to spend it either way. And they can pretend to have a problem with it if they want to, but it's already budgeted. So it doesn't actually throw the spreadsheet off. That would be a way of being both accurate in the spreadsheet making, which is the motivation of the one who's making the spreadsheet.
Right.
But it also is relationship preserving on the other side of things, because now you don't have to make a big deal about it.
Now, what you're talking about there, my friend, is financial subterfuge.
Call it what you want and label that envelope however you want.
What spiritual lessons do you think we can learn from how we handle our money?
I think the greatest one is trust. One of my favorite stories in the Old Testament is the story of Moses and the children of Israel at Mount Sinai, and God has given the law, and all of a sudden, they need to bring in contributions for the tabernacle. For a group of people who are living essentially in the desert, this is a pretty big undertaking to build a tabernacle out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
They've got to put together curtains. They got to chop down wood. They got to build all these furniture pieces. They've got to overlay these furniture pieces with gold. This was a group of slaves.
Yeah.
Where in the world do they get the materials that they need to take care of this job? When they left Egypt, the Egyptians handed them gold and jewelry and all of these things to essentially send them off in good grace because they were so scared of this God who was sending all these plagues. Well, God planned ahead of time without them knowing they would need it to give them all of this gold and materials and fine goods in order to make his tabernacle. They didn't know that's what it was for, but God did.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea of God providing ahead of time, that should help us learn to trust God.
Mm-hmm.
God is constantly providing. And I think sometimes we have this perspective of, when I need it, God will give it to me.
Right.
No, it could be that God gave it to you well ahead of time, knowing you would need it.
Yeah.
And if we were wise with what we have, we would have it. Now, I do think God often provides when we need it, not just before we need it.
Right.
Either way, you've got an issue where we get to trust in God. And I think that's probably one of the greatest spiritual lessons. If God is faithful in the little things, then God is faithful in the big things, just like Jesus said that about us.
There's an old Billy Graham quote, and I think it's probably one of the most astute Billy Graham quotes I've ever heard. He said, "Give me 5 minutes with somebody's checkbook, and I'll tell you where their heart is." I think another spiritual revelation is, what are your real values? I think when you start looking at the money that we have and how that money starts basically flowing out, that it will reveal to you who you are really.
Money reveals our priorities. What you spend your money on is what you consider to be most important.
Yeah.
And so if you spend a lot of money on your hobbies, and you don't spend a lot of money on your children, there's something revealed there.
Yeah.
There's a quote I have in the book. "There are a handful of people whom money won't spoil, and we count ourselves among them." We always consider ourselves to be perfect when it comes to these things. If we would be honest with ourselves about where we spend our money and we go back and look at that, we're going to find out that probably most of us are a little more spoiled than we think we are.
Why is it important for a Christian to give of his or her means to charities as well as the church?
Jesus says, "For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also."
Mm-hmm.
We tend to interpret that scripture backwards. We tend to interpret it as what you care about, that's where you'll spend your money. And that's not at all what Jesus says. Jesus says, where you've already put your money, that's what your heart is going to follow. If you want to care about something, give money to it. That's just a good general rule. You want to be invested in your local congregation, then give a lot of money to it. You're going to start caring a whole lot about the decisions that are made there because you are a part of making those decisions happen. You want to care about heart disease, then give your money to an organization that helps cure heart disease. You want to care about adoption, give your money to Sacred Selections, an adoption agency you and I are both familiar with. Put your money there and your heart's going to follow that.
Yeah.
So charitable giving is a huge part of causing us to keep the right perspective and the right focus.
I've noticed as I've gotten older, if it's free, for some reason we feel open license to criticize it. We will be very critical of things that we think that we can get for free. But when it's something that I've actually put money toward, I feel like I'm a part of the team and I'm no longer criticizing. I'm trying to make it better. In other words, now they've got my money, now they've got my support, now they've got my time, quite frankly. So if I'm working with the Sacred Selections, if I'm getting something from them for free, okay, I'll be more than happy to be critical about whatever it is they're giving me for free. But on the other hand, if I actually donated to the cause, now it's, oh man, they didn't do this very well. Let me help them. I think I can probably help them with this.
We also tend to give value to something based on how much we're willing to give it. I remember back when I used to sell real estate. In doing that, one of the things that our brokers would often talk to us about is don't give away your services for free. You are worth your 3% or 4% or 2.5%. You are whatever the broker's general fee was. They would say, don't give it away for free because people tend to think you are worth what they have to pay you for your services. Mm-hmm. And so if you're cheap, you're trying to do a good thing by lowering your cost, right. Then they're also, in their mind, you are also lowering your value. And I think there's some truth to that when it comes to our charitable giving. When we give bountifully, we are displaying and proving to ourselves that we view this organization or this church in a very valuable way. If we're willing to give it only what's left over, well, then we consider it worth our leftovers.
It reminds me a lot of that idea of sacrifice. God wants the first fruits. He doesn't want the leftovers. If I'm telling on anybody, I'll tell on myself. I look at my budget and I see what I can actually afford to give in the contribution. I understand the reasoning behind that. We cannot afford to give money that we don't have. But by the same token, I think one of the things that God says to us pretty straightforwardly, if it's something that costs you nothing, you will not value it at all. I think about Abraham, who would not pay for the burial place for Sarah. He refused to take something for free because it would cost him something.
And Abraham's a great example of this. There's also the story where we are introduced to Melchizedek. And it's the same sort of thing of, I'm not going to receive the blessings of God and not consider those things to be valuable. Our possessions often become the very standard of value that we place on things.
I think you're right. I think one of the things that happens is we devalue what we're doing. And we feel like we're doing people a favor, and we are. But it reminds me of the defense that Paul is making. There is a criticism from some part of the Corinthians because I haven't taken any money from you guys. No, what I did was I stole from everybody else so that you could get this for free. His unwillingness to take money at some point played into their perception that he had lower credibility at some point.
And what's interesting about Paul is that Paul was doing that because he admitted if he took money from them, that would have been a problem.
Yeah.
And so if he takes money from them, they're going to feel like they can control him or tell him what he needs to do. But if he doesn't take money from them, then they're going to see him as no value. He's in a catch-22 there. How do you answer this for a group of people who are going to misconstrue it either way?
The argument that you're making there, and I think it's a good argument, and I think it's an important argument. People who get value out of something should basically support that. And financially, I would say with your talents, whatever you have at your disposal, use those things to help support an idea, a cause that you think is doing important work.
This will sound self-serving as a preacher, but there's a passage over in Galatians chapter 6, verse 6. Let the one who has taught the word share all his good things with the teacher. If you are receiving value, great value, because you're receiving the word of God, then you should be willing to give value in earthly goods or in good things, as it says there. And just that idea of, like you said, giving value back to what you're receiving value from. The average charitable giving when it comes to religious institutions in America, last statistic I have found, is 1 to 2%. It's 1 to 2% giving. And that's of those who give. So that's not counting all the ones who aren't religious, who don't go to any sort of religious institution.
Right.
So for those who actually go to some church or some organization that's religious and takes charitable giving, people give 1-2%. I know God did not command a tithe for us in the new covenant. Let's say we took that as a base standard of our giving. Could you imagine if all Christians literally gave 10% of their income, what the church would be capable of doing? It is amazing to see how honestly we as Christians stunt the kingdom because, let's be honest, we have too many car payments, bills, cable bills, and all these other things that we are tied up with. And we give God what's left over because that's all we can afford. It would be amazing to see what God could do if we actually all gave, probably more in keeping with what we all would think we should be giving.
There's nobody more guilty than I am of that. This is an indictment on myself. I realize, of course, you are above reproach on this. Because
absolutely not.
I was not expecting this to be a guilt session on Sunday morning giving. Maybe it should be, and maybe that's one of the lessons we need to learn from this. We keep on talking about how a church is not a social organization, but when you start looking at the way we treat it sometimes, it's really little better than the Rotary Club in some ways. And that's, again, not us bragging on ourselves, that we look at it just as another volunteer organization that we're a part of that only thrives based on our investment of resources rather than what God has invested in us.
I don't mean to give that statistic and give these details to create guilt in people. Honestly, think there's a lot of people who give what they're capable of giving. We tie ourselves up, and honestly, we indebt ourselves to all of these lenders and enslave mm-hmm. ourselves and tie our hands behind our backs. And then we're unable to give what we know we should give or what we want to give.
Yeah.
And then that leaves us in difficult circumstances.
Yeah. And I think it also leaves us in a position where we no longer feel like we are in charge of our finances, but we are victims to our finances. That's just not any way to live. And it's the way I live. Again, these are the things that we are expected to purchase. These are the trips that we are expected to make. And I'm not even talking about extravagant trips. I'm talking about the trip to go see your parents. That's a hard one. Let me ask you this, because I think it's one of the questions in your book. Why don't we think we're rich?
I think we have misdefined what rich is. We tend to view rich in terms of numbers. Mm-hmm. Or we tend to view rich in terms of convenience. Mm-hmm. I think that's where most of us put our thinking when it comes to our money and our finances.
Yeah.
We are concerned with how convenient life is. We are not concerned necessarily even with how much stuff we have. Our greatest standard is having ease of life. And so the more ease we have, the more wealth, the more rich we feel. The
yeah.
problem with that is life isn't easy. It's not easy for any of us. And there's a lot of things that happen to us in our lives that are not affected by how much money we have. You buy a house. It might be a nice house, but the house all of a sudden has a foundation crack in it. Mm-hmm. You could have felt like the wealthiest person in the world when you were living in that house for the first 6 months. But when that crack showed up, now all of a sudden you feel like the poorest person in the world. Yeah. Same house.
Yeah.
Now your life has become not easy. You can have a nice car, but when the car starts breaking down, now you don't feel so wealthy anymore because right. you've reassessed what is nice and what isn't. And so it becomes oftentimes about what is easy. And that's not even to talk about the fact that if your marriage is struggling, well, then life, it doesn't matter how much stuff you have. You don't feel wealthy. You don't feel rich. You don't feel blessed.
Right.
If your children are struggling, if they don't have all the things they need, all of these things wrap up into this concept of richness and wealth. And the problem with all of it is it betrays our thinking, because honestly, God never promised life to be easy, And God promised that we would live a life that would bring us to trust in Him. So when we find ourselves worrying about life and worrying about money, what we're doing is we are declaring with that worry, God's provision isn't enough.
Yeah.
One of the things I talk about in the book is God does not intend for all of us to be traditionally the way we traditionally think about it. What you have, because it's what God has blessed you with.
Right.
Now, we can be wiser with those things. We can make better decisions. But ultimately, if God wants you to live on $40,000 a year, you need to figure out how to make $40,000 a year work and be content with that.
Yeah.
And if for some reason God blesses you and you go from $40,000 to $80,000 a year, that shouldn't change your perspective or your attitude about God or your attitude about life.
Right.
That is a number change. It is not a life change. It's the same God in control. Mm-hmm. It's the same God who has blessed you. And you have the same sort of decisions to make, no matter what the number on the bottom line is.
We often hear, compared to the world, we are very wealthy. I'm not going to disagree with that. I think that makes a lot of sense. We undoubtedly are very wealthy. Do you think because the United States is one of the wealthiest countries in the world, that we are also the most blessed country in the world?
We are the most spoiled country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I would not say that we are the most blessed country in the world, because blessings are not monetary. They are relational. So the same potential for relationships exist no matter how much money is in the bank account. The same potential of relationship with God exists no matter how big of a check you can write. The relational blessings are really where blessings are found. Mm-hmm. So I would say that the wealthiness of our country, in a lot of ways, that has probably hurt our blessings more than it is a blessing. We are also the country with the most potential of any country in the world. And while I would say we are the most spoiled country, we are also the country set up to do the most good if we would put the focus back on relationships and using money as a tool.
There's a guy that defined blessing and curse. And I know these are not scriptural definitions, but he defined a blessing as anything that draws you toward God and a curse is anything that draws you away from God. And the thing that I like about that, you can see awfully quickly how money can be either a blessing or a curse. You said it at the very beginning, it's a tool. And those tools can be used for good or ill. And I guess the best description of really any of these resources is, are we good stewards or are we terrible stewards? And that just has to do with, how much stuff have you been given and what can you do with the stuff that you are given?
People like to throw that word steward out a lot. And I think in religious circles, that makes sense. We don't really use that word a lot in everyday life. I don't know if you do in the classroom. You talk to your students about being good stewards. But it is a word that I think is often misunderstood.
Yeah,
but I think it is a word that is extremely applicable in the context of talking about money. You know, your job is to take what belongs to somebody else and accomplish purposes with it. If I send my kid to the store and I tell him to go in and grab a gallon of milk and two loaves of bread, and he comes out with a gallon of milk and two loaves of bread, he's been a good steward. He accomplished my purposes. If he comes out with nothing and says, hey, Dad, I decided not to spend your money, that's not a good steward.
No.
That might have been a good money manager. Even if he comes out and says, hey, Dad, while I was in there, I remembered milk is $3 cheaper at this other store, and then bread is $1 cheaper a loaf at this other store. We need to go there to buy it. He's still not being a good steward, because he didn't accomplish my goal. If it's mine. He's supposed to do with it what I said to do with it.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we're that way on money and being stewards of, okay, I'm supposed to be a steward of God's blessings. Well, we don't always understand what that means,
right,
and how far to go with that. If what I own belongs to God, what are the ramifications of that? Does that mean I can't buy myself a new guitar? As you see guitars behind me on the wall there. Does that mean that's totally a selfish purpose and I can't use God's money for my own selfish purposes? Technically, yes. And we're very uncomfortable with that. Oftentimes I'll get questions about, is it wrong for me to go on this vacation with my family? Because I could use this money for charitable giving, or I could use this money to help someone adopt, or I could use this money for God's purposes. And we struggle with that. Ultimately, it goes back to that key word we used earlier, balance. Mm-hmm. God's purpose is not to rob us of all joy.
Right.
God's purpose is to give us the ability to accomplish his purposes. God's purpose is for us to be in a relationship with him. I'll go back to my illustration with my kid. I sent him into the store for milk and bread. Mm-hmm. He goes, he gets the milk, he gets the bread. Suddenly my phone rings and he says, hey, Dad, they have a new kind of candy bar in here. Do you mind if I pick it up? I want to try it. My answer to him is probably going to be, absolutely, get me one too. because I want him to have joy too.
Right.
And so that, I think, is probably a better illustration. I know when it comes to my finances, God wants me to enjoy my family and to give my family relationship building experiences. It's not wrong for me to take them on vacation. You know, he has already given me permission for that. Now, can I do that, but not buy the milk and bread that he told me to buy? No.
Right.
And that's where the balance comes in.
Adam, I've got four kids. Two of them are in college right now. They're just getting to the point where they're making a little bit of their own money. I've got one that has a McDonald's job and he's doing pretty good with it. And then I've got another who is in a very demanding college program. She's living primarily off student loans right now. What kind of advice should I give my kids?
I think the best advice you can give them, it's probably going to be very similar to the advice you already give them in most other areas of life, which is pursue God first. That's going to be key. Pursue mm-hmm. God first. But when it comes to finances, that same advice works. How can you use your money to serve God first? Now, that's going to look like a couple of different things. One is going to be the charitable giving we've already talked about. One is going to be using his blessings to allow yourself to not get tied up and enslaved to debtors to the point where you can't do God's work. When we allow ourselves to get just so strapped up in debt, now we don't have the freedom to go serve God without hesitation. You know, spend in a way that allows you to continue putting God first. And then ultimately, what is the wisest use of money and figuring out how to make those wise decisions? Spending every penny you got might be fun. I don't think most of us would consider it wise. And then ultimately, I tell you, the one thing that I'm working with my own kids about, I've got five kids.
Wow.
And the oldest is 15 and has started working during the summer times. He worked for the library this last year. And so he's saved up money. He's saving up for a car and things like that. But one of the things that I keep trying to drill into them is it doesn't matter how much money you have. What matters is the person you are.
Right.
There's a quote that I include in my book. It says, the real measure of your wealth is how much you'd be worth if you lost all your money. The value of who you are is not ever going to be seen on a spreadsheet.
Right.
It's going to be seen in who you are and how people perceive you and the relationships that you build. And most importantly, the relationship you have with God. And your son and your daughter, who are both in college, who they are is more important than what they do, and it's more important than how much they have, right. And it's more important than really any issue that money is ever going to touch. So let your money reflect who you are.
I think one of the things that we get hung up on a lot, it's impossible, especially with those first jobs, not to paycheck compare with your peers to find out how well you're doing. It's impossible not to do that, but I don't know that it's very helpful to do that. I was in professions that did not pay pretty much anything. But the thing about it is I had a ball and I made some great friends. And if you were to ask me today how much I made at that time, I don't know that I could tell you anymore. I think what I would tell you is I learned so much and I made some lifelong friends doing that. That said, money is important because it does become a tool. But I guess this happens when you get older. I see money as a renewable resource, but most everything else I don't. Relationships are not renewable resources. Time is not a renewable resource. There are times when I'm very happy to sacrifice money in order to have time with my kids or have time with people that make a difference in my life.
Keep money in perspective.
Yeah.
And keep it with the right attitude. The greater thing is the blessings. And the blessings is not going to be found in a bank account. It's going to be found in the people.
Right.
And if you can use money as a tool to lead to the blessings, then that's a good use of money.
It reminds me of that very controversial parable that Jesus talks about, the unjust manager. The manager who basically tells everybody to have all the debts that they have because he realizes he's about to lose his job. And the debate that we always have is, isn't he sinning when he does that? But I think what you're bringing out there is he understands that the relationship is more important than the number on a bill. How would you define that parable? What's the point of it?
I think we struggle with the parable. And again, I'm by no means the expert on that parable. I have my own particular take on it that I've had plenty of people argue with me about.
Oh, really?
In that I don't believe that the master in this parable represents God per se. And that's what oftentimes makes us uncomfortable with it. Right. But I think you're right there. The reason he is deemed as acting shrewdly and he is commended for that is because by the course of his actions, what he did was he actually made things better for the manager than had he done nothing, which is what he had previously been doing.
Right.
And so his actions to use these debts, to use this financial arrangement in order to preserve relationships is actually what he was supposed to have been doing in the first place.
Yeah,
I think that's ultimately what you deal with here. I was talking to a friend of mine earlier who is potentially facing some litigation. And when the lawyers talked, the first thing that the lawyer representing the company trying to collect a large sum of money, the first thing out of that lawyer's mouth was, do we want to reach a settlement? That was the expectation. Oftentimes when there's a debt involved, the issue is not the full amount of money. The issue for the manager, the issue for the collector is we want to make an arrangement to collect what we can collect. Mm-hmm. This unrighteous servant had been doing nothing and not collecting anything. And so when he finally collected something, he's actually doing what the manager wanted him to do all along. Now, that's my own personal take on the story, which, I'm sure there will be plenty of people who disagree with that. But again, it's one of those in that situation, or we can think of other situations in our lives where there are difficulties that we face financially. There are struggles that we handle. What gets us through all of these difficult moments in life? It's not typically having an extra paycheck. It's the people God puts in our lives that really make the difference. Yeah. And so we need to be the kind of people who can keep the most important things in front. Let money be a tool. Let everything else be what we really focus on. I like the way you worded it. It's a renewable resource. It really is. It is something you can always make more, and you can always lose it as fast as you make it. And yeah. It is a completely unreliable master. It is an unreliable tool oftentimes, but it is something that is necessary and something that we can do wisely with or poorly with, depending on the way we keep our attitudes about it.
I was watching one of these YouTube influencers. One of the things that he did, he pulled out $1.7 million and he just put it in two neat stacks on a table. And he said, that right there is the average lifetime earnings of an American. That right there. And that two stacks of bills is what most people are chasing after.
Wow.
He said, it's funny to see that a lot of people will define their lives by those two neat stacks of bills. And I remember looking at that and thinking, isn't it pathetic? That's what we do. And one of the things he said was, you are both limiting yourselves, but he also said, seek after things that are not two stacks of green colored paper. And I thought, how profound is that? That spoke a lot to me. Adam, what have I missed? We've talked a lot about money. What have I missed?
We've talked about the attitude we should have for money. We've talked about the way we should view money, that it reveals our character, that it reveals what we care about, all of those types of things. The real perspective that blessings are different than money, that blessings are relationship. I would add to that, my first job I ever had was as a paper boy. And this was at one of the few papers in Maryland that still actually had paper boys. I had two routes. I'd get up at 4 o'clock in the morning on Wednesdays and I'd fold these papers and put them in my bag and go out there and walk and deliver these papers through two different neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And I decided to quit because I got tired of doing that job. And the way that worked was I was responsible for delivering the papers and for collecting the payments and then giving the paper company their portion and I got whatever was left over. So it was a pretty simple arrangement. When I quit, they were also switching management and they never came to collect from me. 2 months, 3 months, 4 months went by, never came to collect from me. I'm sitting here with, I think, $600 on my dresser and they never came to get it. So I asked my friend who was also a paper boy. He goes, oh, your name's off the board. It hasn't been on the board for a long time. You just go spend it. So I went and spent it. And I had a day spending all that money. Back in those days, I think I spent probably the majority of it on CDs. My CD collection just went off the charts. It was amazing. And then 2 weeks later, the manager called and said, hey, I just realized we forgot to come get the money from you. And I needed to find $500 really fast. Because my parents found out that I now owed a company $500 and I had no way of getting the money.
Right.
So my dad, let's just say he was not pleased. And he told me, you have 2 weeks to get that money back. Mm-hmm. 2 weeks to earn $500, what took me months to earn ahead of that. So I took a lawnmower and I got out there and I did the work because that's what was required. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's kind of my point in telling this story, is I think sometimes one of the bad attitudes we have about money is that we view ourselves as victims, or we view ourselves as those who really don't have any control over this, and that's just not true.
Right.
If you're willing to go out there and do the work, God has continually been willing to make ends meet and to put things together. I know there's always exceptions to the rules and there's always circumstances that make that difficult. But as a general rule for most of us, if we're willing to go out there and do the hard thing, we will experience blessings from that. We will experience things coming together in a way maybe they haven't before. And so I would encourage anybody who is trying to figure out how to handle their money, do the hard work of figuring this out. My book is one of many books that are out there, and I try to take more of a biblical perspective, but there's a lot of good resources out there. Get some of those resources and make hard decisions and do the hard work so that you can see what comes together for you. Ultimately, all of that comes back to making sure you keep the right perspective about money. But one of the greatest perspectives I think that we need to hear in our world today is to stop being a victim and start being willing to get out there and do good things.
I end all of my podcasts with be good and do good. Adam, what's good?
Many things, but in the context of our discussion, blessings. And I mean that not in terms of bank accounts, but in terms of relationships. That relationship with God, that relationship with others, that's where the good things rest.
We did not talk at all about your own podcast, which is called Preach Impediments. Did you want to talk about that for a second?
Absolutely. Strangest name ever, I recognize. But as from having listened to this podcast, I have a lisp. I have one of those speech impediments. And so I was thinking about just the things that we do to interfere with the message of God. And oftentimes that's using those big words. And I thought it would be good to have a podcast where I work with other people, various people week after week, to make those big words easy to understand, removing those, what's called preach impediments, removing those from our thinking.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, I've listened to, I think, all of your episodes at this point. Steve Wolfgang did a fabulous job. Jeremy Dutt. You have BJ Sipe on there as well, and Jonathan Caldwell, and Tommy Peeler, my goodness. You've had some really good guys on there. And so one of the things that I would say is, if you haven't listened to Preach Impediments, do yourself a favor and do that. He's doing good work over there. And some of these guys, you've talked to some really good guys, and you're doing good work with that. I really appreciate you doing that, man.
It's been fun, and I've had a fun time because I'm trying to reach people that I don't know well and people that I do know well and just let them take the conversation and run with it. So that has been a blast.
That is so smart. And I've said it before, and I'll say it again. If you keep on saying that there's just nothing good about the internet, you're not looking at the right parts. This is one of the good things. So start looking for the good stuff. It's there. If somebody wanted to get a hold of you, Adam, how could they do that?
The easiest way would be my website is edenhollow.com. That's where I have information about my books. You'll find In God We Trust over there. Preachimpediments.com also points to a part of that website, which is about the podcast. Or you're welcome to just reach out to me. My email is adam@edenhollow.net, or you could even give me a phone call or a text at 205-675-4391. I know you're not supposed to give your phone number out on the internet, but we'll do it here because I trust your audience.
Well, very good. I really appreciate you doing this, Adam.
Thank you, Kenny. This has been a lot of fun.
Like most people, I have had a complex relationship with my money in my entire life. And as my kids get older, I think Adam's perspective on money is one I would love to see them adopt. Adam, thank you for what you do and being who you are. As for the good thing I'm thinking about, my voice is coming back after essentially losing it for the last week. It's not 100% yet, but I was forced to be quiet for a while and listen more. There's a lot of wisdom in that. I'm grateful for both healing and for being quiet. I was recently interviewed for Jared Bowman's podcast, Man Up. You can hear my raspy voice slowly disintegrating, but I thought Jared did an excellent job. I recommend to you what we were talking about. I'm also happy to recommend another Facebook group my buddy Hal Hammonds has created for his podcast, Citizen of Heaven. I recommend Hal. I recommend his Facebook group. I recommend his podcast. He's a good guy that you would do well to know. I've also put a place on my website, balancingthechristianlife.com, for you to put your name and email address for a newsletter I'd like to pull together. There's no cost, but it will be something where I can talk more directly with people who listen to the podcast. And I think that's an excellent thing. Finally, I want to give my sincere thanks to those who financially support the podcast, like Don Nietzsche, Kevin Hansen, George Sanchez, Deanna Warren, Chris Kramer, Barbara McElwain, and my parents. If you would like to support the podcast as well, I've included information on that in the show notes and also on my website. I have to admit, it's nice to have some of the costs of the podcast covered, but it's even nicer to know the support I have from people who simply like the program. You'll never know how much I appreciate these acts of kindness. If you would like to help as well, just go to my website to see how. So until next time, let's be good and do good.